How would you like to attend a conference and hear Paul Meyer, Molly Ziegler-Hemingway, David Menton, Chris Rosebrough, Jonathan Fisk, and Will Wheaton? You're invited to the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 19th and 20th in Collinsville, Illinois. Registration is $100 per person. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 19th and 20th in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. You might have seen this column in the New York Times by Frank Bruni. The column's titled Bigotry, the Bible, and the Lessons of Indiana. It pretty much is a summary of and a clarion call to those who have decided that, well, religious freedom in Indiana is just one too many states declaring religious freedom. And in particular, for some reason, Christians are being targeted here, although Christians are not the only ones who are afforded religious freedom or religious liberty in the United States. The title alone is enough to kind of get your curiosity going. And then when you read lines like religion is going to be the final holdout and the most stubborn refuge for homophobia, it will give license to discrimination. Conservative Christian religion is the last bulwark against full acceptance of LGBT people. Well, it does more than pique your interest. What is this column saying, and how should we respond to it if we're concerned about religious freedom? Joining us to answer a couple of those questions, Rod Dreher. He's a regular guest, senior editor at the American Conservative, author of the books The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, Crunchy Cons, and his latest publication, How Dante Can Save Your Life, The Life-Changing Wisdom of History's Greatest Poem. Rod, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Todd, it's been a long time. Great to be back with you.
Before we get to the kind of headline-making quote from the New York Times column from Mitchell Gold of Faith in America, there was another one in that piece where Bruni quotes David Gushee, and the quote is this. I want to know, is he right? David Gushee says, the conservative Christian religion is the last bulwark against full acceptance of LGBT people. Is Gushee right?
I think he's absolutely right, but of course the reason he was saying it is because he's a liberal evangelical and he wants to point out to the New York Times who the enemy is. And I completely oppose what David Gushee has to say. I resent the reason I believe he said it, but I think he's absolutely right. The traditional small O Orthodox Christian church, whether you're Catholic, Protestant, or Eastern Orthodox, is the last bulwark.
Now, I wonder if you would quibble with the bulwark against what? Because he says the acceptance of LGBT people. Would you want to nuance that? Because I think there's a devil in the details of that word acceptance.
Oh, absolutely. When he says acceptance, he means approval. Approval of gay sex and homosexuality, which is not something that Orthodox Christianity can do. We can certainly and we must accept gay people in terms of affirming their humanity. We're sinners just like they're sinners, but we cannot do what David Gushee has done and would have the rest of us do, which is to say that there's no sin there. That's just, that requires too much of a leap away from scripture and tradition to make it work.
Well, that leads us to the Mitchell Gold quote in Bruni's piece. Mitchell Gold, the founder of Faith in America, a homosexual activist group. Gold, according to Bruni, said that church leaders must be made to take homosexuality off the sin list. Bruni comments, this commandment is worthy and warranted. What was Gold saying?
Well, that chilled me when I read that, because what he's saying is that Christian churches must be coerced, must be forced to recant what we believe is true, what 2,000 years of Christianity, until the day before yesterday, all Christian churches believe this was true. And if he had said something like, the Christian churches should be encouraged to or convinced to, that's one thing, that's fine, that's free speech. But he said made, and Frank Bruni of the New York Times legitimized that and said absolutely. That is chilling, because I think that really does reveal to the rest of the country what they're after, that they're not going to stop at just tolerance or agreeing to disagree. They're going to use everything possible in the culture and, I think, ultimately in the law to make us bow.
Well, I mean, if we were just at the beginning of this conversation, if we were just at the beginning of this conflict, I might not be as worried. But their track record so far, the track record of the highly organized, very well-funded campaign to force gay marriage on everyone, period, has, well, they've already proven what methods they're willing to go to, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. Look at Brendan Eich out in California, the Mozilla CEO. He was thrown out of his job because of a private donation, a small private donation he gave to the Prop 8 campaign 7 or 8 years ago, when he took exactly the same position that a lot of prominent Democrats took at the time. But now that's considered a firing offense, and he started the company. I think that the Indiana backlash has really opened the eyes of a lot of Christians to what the real stakes are here. I can't tell you how many people I've heard from privately, including some people who are pretty high up in the Christian world, who were shocked by the vehemence and the vitriol of the attack on Indiana and on Governor Pence. And frankly, they were amazed that the Governor Pence and Governor Hutchinson of Arkansas yielded so quickly. I think that the Republicans have really botched this because they have not anticipated how powerful the business lobby would be when it got behind the LGBT. And I think that we're in for uncharted territory in the church in this country.
If my count was correct, Indiana was the 20th state to pass something like this, Arkansas the 21st. Why was Indiana singled out? After it seems as though the reaction should have come earlier or should be spread out a little among some of those states that have passed almost precisely the same legislation.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. I was talking yesterday on background with a Christian legal strategist who's at the top of these behind-the-scenes legislative battles. And he said that the big change that's happened in the past 2 years is the business community, which used to stay out of these things, has jumped in with both feet on the side of the LGBT crowd, LGBT movement. He said that Christians and social conservatives are completely outmatched at the legislative level. The Democrats are, as he put it, they are owned by the LGBT movement at the same way that the Republican Party is owned by the NRA. You just cannot go against them if you're a Democrat. He said the Republicans may be fair weather friends because they don't know how to fight this issue, but they're the only friends the church has. He also said that we have got to start looking at the Utah model. You may remember that Utah came to a compromise to guard religious freedom, but also granting some civil rights protections to LGBTs. And it was something signed off on by the Mormon Church and by the big gay rights groups. My source told me that this is really the only hope we have going forward, because if we Christians try to protect everything, we're going to end up losing everything. We've got to start making some strategic decisions about which religious liberties we are prepared to fight for and which ones we're willing to let go so we can defend the ones that are non-negotiable.
Okay, speaking of the non-negotiables, you have kind of constructed recently in a piece that you wrote called Cake and Cosmology, a little thought experiment, a hypothetical, with kind of three stages, beginning with one of your gay friends decides, you're a baker, Rod, one of your gay friends asks you to bake a birthday cake for his partner. Would you? The second question, one of your gay friends has a partner who dies, and the partner asks you to bake a cake for the reception at the funeral. Would you do so? And then finally, the third one that has somehow kind of oddly become the touchstone of true tolerance. Gay marriage is legalized in your state. The gay couple comes asking you to bake the wedding cake. Would you? What are your answers to those three hypotheticals?
My answers are yes, yes, and no. I would have no trouble baking a cake for my gay neighbor if we were friends normally. I have many gay friends. I share their lives. They share my lives. I've always had gay friends, and I see no reason why I shouldn't do an ordinary act of kindness and friendship for them, and certainly at a time of sorrow, if one of them died. It does not mean I approve of their gay relationship any more than my neighbors who live together without being married, my heterosexual neighbors, any more than I approve of their relationship if I shared food with them. On the other hand, in the third case, that involves a public recognition that theirs is a marriage, and especially if it's in some sort of church, because that brings God into it. That is not something that I feel comfortable affirming. Doesn't mean I don't love these people. I do. Doesn't mean I wouldn't help them in almost every case. But I can't say that what they call marriage is really marriage. It's just not in the cards. But that is the thing that has become the make-or-break issue for so many on the LGBT side, because they don't really want tolerance. They want to approve. They want Christians to approve and turn their back on historical teaching. And I think it's something that Christians have to be prepared to suffer for, quite frankly, and we are going to be made to suffer for it, make no mistake.
Returning to the New York Times column by Frank Bruni, one of the things he concedes early in the column is that these beliefs about homosexuality and marriage among most Christians aren't really about hatred. And it's refreshing to hear him say that. It's about deeply ingrained beliefs that are just completely illogical and no longer in currency and no longer necessary. It's about holding to anachronistic views of homosexuality, particularly those of the ancient world, the biblical times. How would you respond to him?
Well, I would say something along the lines of what his New York Times colleague Ross Douthat, who is a Christian, said in his column on Sunday on the same page. He said that a lot of LGBT folks and their allies say that if the church changed on racism, then it can certainly change on gay marriage. Well, Ross pointed out that, you know, that racism in the church was only a white Southern antebellum thing, or even postbellum thing. It has no strong basis in Christianity. But homosexuality goes all the way back to the beginning. It goes back to man and woman, he created them, to Genesis. It is woven so deeply within a Christian cosmology, which is to say the way God created all things, created reality. We cannot simply extract that out of the faith and have the faith make any sense. It's so deeply embedded in Scripture and in our natures. So all I would do is ask my LGBT friends to say, listen, I know you don't agree with us here, but understand why we believe what we believe. It's not because of some obscure verses in Leviticus. This is very, very deep in our understanding of the world. You're asking us to assent to a lie, and that is something that we cannot do.
Rod Dreher is our guest. We're talking about a recent New York Times column titled Bigotry, the Bible, and the Lessons of Indiana. When we come back, Christians are hardly alone in their principled opposition to these kinds of things. We'll talk about that. Stay tuned. Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues, Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
I just find it fascinating that so many of the issues that are out there right now are based on this false notion that men and women are completely interchangeable.
Molly Ziegler-Hemingway talking about her presentation at this summer's Issues, Etc. Making the Case conference.
I mean, all these really hot-button issues are based on some confusion about where men and women are equal, in what terms are they equal, and then, you know, most importantly, how are we different, and is that difference a bad thing? Is it a good thing? You know, what does God have to say about these differences, and, you know, how should the Christian think about these differences? So I am so excited to come to this conference and talk about these issues which animate so much of our political and social and cultural discourse, and also the things we struggle with in the church as well.
You can meet and hear Molly Ziegler-Hemingway making the case for the differences between men and women June 19th and 20th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Rod Dreher, senior editor at the American Conservative, about a recent New York Times column titled Bigotry, the Bible, and the Lessons of Indiana. Rod, one of the things that's often missed, and it's a little frustrating, but it's often missed by the media, is that Christians are hardly alone in their principled opposition to these things, to redefining marriage and their principled opposition to homosexual behavior, are they?
Oh, no, not at all. Orthodox Jews and Muslims agree. And in fact, I was talking to a law professor last week. I call him Professor Kingsfield in my blog at the American Conservative because he's a Christian at an elite law school who is deeply closeted because he would suffer if people knew who he was. And but he's very well informed about these things. And he said that some of the religious liberties legal funds, like the Beckett Fund, they do a good job of picking sympathetic clients. They know that there's a lot of prejudice against Christians, especially evangelical Christians, in the legal system. So whenever there's a principle they want to defend, they try to find a Muslim or a Jew or someone of a minority religion that will get a more sympathetic hearing in the courts. It shouldn't be that way. Justice should be blind, but as Justice Scalia pointed out in 2003 in the Lawrence dissent, in the judgment that legalized sodomy, he said the legal culture is completely given over to gay activism in this country. Scalia said that 12 years ago, and it's only gotten more and more true. That's why I put Professor Kingsfield told me that it's time for Christians to wake up and understand what we're facing and prepare for it has been electrifying to a lot of my readers, as it was to me.
What you're saying there, really, or what he is saying there, is that both the nature and the purpose of law has shifted in American culture.
Oh, it has. Yeah, this is the fruit of the sexual revolution. You know, when people began to see sexuality as constitutive of one's identity, then to deny someone's sexual desire or sexual expression or to stigmatize it in any way is seen as denying them as a person. Justice Kennedy, in his Planned Parenthood v. Casey majority opinion defending Roe v. Wade, he said that at the heart of liberty is the right to decide truth and falsity for yourself. Now, if that's true, that, as Justice Scalia said, is the end of the rule of law. We can just make it up as we go along. I think that what Kennedy said is what most Americans actually believe. And get this, Todd, just before you called, I got an email from a staffer at a conservative Protestant liberal arts college who was telling me that a lot of people in this country, a lot of evangelicals, have no idea how far this stuff has gone in colleges, even conservative ones. And he said, I really don't know how long we're going to be able to hold the line because none of the students would know Christian orthodoxy on sexual teaching if it was standing right in front of them.
So one of the other things that's highlighted in the New York Times column is that with kind of glowing praise, there are some more enlightened Protestant denominations called prominent, although hardly numerically prominent any longer. Among them, the Episcopal Church USA, the United Church of Christ, Presbyterian Church USA, a few others that have gone. They have bowed to the LGBT agenda, and they have not only expressed tolerance but affirmation for just about everything on their list of demands. And he says, well, you know, there is really kind of the future for Christianity, this willingness to put aside the old ideas and to embrace the obvious truths that are just staring everyone in the face. What do you say?
Yeah, that's the future of a Christianity that wants to jump in the grave. There is absolutely no evidence that this has ever done any good. The Episcopal Church, for example, it is liberalized in every possible way on sexual matters, and it's dying. The church, almost all churches in Europe are dead. They've liberalized. It's done them no good. The Presbyterian Church, USA, and on and on and on. If it would work, I could see there being a pragmatic argument for that. But A, it's unprincipled, and B, it doesn't work. Now, I have to say that conservative churches, such as my own church and your church, you know, we may hold the line on this, but we're going to lose a lot of Christians, a lot of believers because of this. But in the end, I think those that stay behind will be what Pope Benedict XVI called a creative minority. You know, this will be a time of testing, a time of winnowing out the lukewarm from those who really believe and who are willing to say Jesus is Lord. But I think from that core is going to come a rebirth one day. You and I might not live to see it, but I think that our grandchildren will.
He also cites this growing statistics of the average kind of self-identified Roman Catholic or Jew or Protestant who in growing numbers are willing to accept what he calls marriage equality, in particular with regard to the Roman Catholic end of that. Sounds like he's basically saying, look, this is the tide of history, even within previously principled opposition to homosexuality.
You know, that is a really interesting point because, as you know, I was a Roman Catholic for 13 years. I'm Eastern Orthodox now. And one of the things that's amazing to me from the outside, looking in at the Roman Catholic Church, it seems to be completely solid on these issues. Its teachings could not be more clear. The last two popes they've had, Pope Benedict, Pope John Paul, made this a cornerstone of their teaching. The new guy, Francis, not so sure about that. But it doesn't really matter. There is a de facto schism within the Roman Catholic Church between people who really believe what it teaches and those who are Catholic in name only. I think that people who think that the real battle here over same-sex marriage in our culture is going to be between different churches, like Lutheran on one side, you know, Episcopalian on the other, they're wrong. This fight is going to go right down the heart of every church in America.
You've written recently about kind of the virtue of resistance, and I don't know if you're citing Robbie George or if you are. If this is something you've written, you say, I'm not asking which leaders will stand up and refuse to be intimidated into silence. You say, I'm asking what ordinary people will do. Why is that question so important?
Because we all have to realize, Todd, what this is going to cost us. We all have to be prepared to make our own sacrifices in whatever way is asked of us. You know, just this morning, I was in church. This is our Holy Week for the Orthodox, and we were celebrating the Annunciation, you know, when the Archangel Gabriel came to the Virgin Mary, and she said, let it be done to me according to thy word. She said that knowing that she was going to do God's will, even though it could get her killed in her culture. And I thought, you know what? We need the courage of that Hebrew woman, Mary, the mother of Jesus, because we need to be willing to, ordinary people need to be willing to stand up and suffer for the sake of the gospel. And it's going to be asked of us. It really will be. I've talked for the past few years about this thing I call the Benedict option, after Saint Benedict of Nursia, the early church saint who founded monasticism in Western Europe. Saint Benedict saw what was happening in post-Roman society. Everything was falling apart. He went out into the woods to pray and gathered holy men around him. Because they got together just to pray and live out the life of faith in community in a culture that was chaotic, a Dark Ages culture that was completely chaotic, they laid the groundwork for the rebirth of Christian civilization in the West. I believe that right now is the time for people, ordinary people and church leaders, Protestant, Catholic, everybody, to start making these plans now for how we are going to resist the gathering storm, so our children will grow up holding the faith, holding onto it tight, holding onto it in joy, not in fear, but passing it on from generation to generation.
Rob, before we let you go, tell us about your latest book, How Dante Can Save Your Life.
Boy, thank you for asking about that. I'm so excited about this book, Todd. The last book I wrote was called The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, and it was about my decision to come back to my hometown in South Louisiana after the beautiful death of my sister Ruthie, my younger sister, who met her death from cancer at an early age with a great deal of faith and love. It inspired me and my wife to move back down south so we could help her family, her husband, and raise his kids and help my elderly parents. Well, it turned out that that didn't really work out. They didn't receive me as I wanted to be received, as I hoped to be received, because, as it happened, my sister held a secret grudge against me for moving away from the country into the city, and it taught her children not to trust me because I was a city boy, the uncle who got above his raising. And I went into a deep depression and physical illness related to the stress of all that. What happened was God used that to break me of a lot of intellectual pride I had. And one of the things he used to bring me out of my depression and out of my physical illness was the Divine Comedy of Dante Alighieri, the 14th century Catholic poet. I had never read the Inferno, the Purgatorio, and the Paradiso before, but I stumbled into it while I was lost in my own dark wood of depression and physical illness. And the Lord just used that powerful poem, that work of art, to bring me out of my state and restore me to himself. He also used my pastor, and he used a Southern Baptist therapist who helped me. But most of all, it was the gift of Dante. I tell that story in my book, and I really hope it brings a lot of people, not only to Dante, to this incredible great book we have that's right under our noses, but it helps them realize that this is the greatest self-help book, greatest Christian self-help book ever written.
Folks, you'll find a link to How Dante Can Save Your Life and Rod Dreher's columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Rod Dreher is senior editor at the American Conservative, author of the books The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, Crunchy Cons, and his latest publication, How Dante Can Save Your Life, The Life-Changing Wisdom of History's Greatest Poem. Rod, thank you very much for being our guest.
Always a pleasure.
When we come back, your answer to the question, what's your favorite Easter hymn and why? That's how we're going to kick off this post-Easter, beginning of Easter season, Tuesday afternoon, April the 7th. Your answers to the question, what's your favorite Easter hymn and why? Open Lines is next.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Why did Frederick III risk his realm of Saxony to protect Martin Luther and the developing reforms of the church? The Issues Etc. book of the month for April is Frederick the Wise, Seen and Unseen Lives of Martin Luther's Protector. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Frederick the Wise by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. book of the month for April, Frederick the Wise.